Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Zach's in.
Even that mean old son of a gun, the Boggy Creek Monster. But this week, I'm going to introduce you to the weirdest creature that's ever walked out of the forest. He's big, he's hairy, he's scary, and his name is Momo.
Is that it? Is that the creature?
It's time to find out.
As we do each week on Blackburn's Cryptid Case Files, I'm going to introduce you to a schlocky film inspired by the creepy critter I'll be investigating this episode. Let's set the stage for the film you're about to watch. In the early 1970s, a filmmaker by the name of Charles B. Pierce made an independent horror movie about a monster roaming the swamps of southern Arkansas. It was called The Legend of Boggy Creek, and it was made for very little money, but quickly became a hit on the drive-in movie circuit. Before you could say the word...
All right, that's enough. This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my pal, Mark Matzke.
Yo.
This week, we also have other guests.
Doing it a little different.
You got to talk in...
a different...
We're live.
we're live. Mics are hot. Let me think of how to introduce you. Co-writer and sound recordist, Jason Udis.
Hi.
We're clapping. director of photography, Zach Palmisano.
Hi.
And actor slash producer, Adam Dugan.
Hi.
Got to say it a little louder.
Hi.
Okay.
Still directing.
Monsteropolis
gotta
is
better than that.
Louder.
Monsteropolis is the official show of Small Town Monsters, an indie film production company focused on strange and unusual activities around the United States. What do we have in the way of events? Friday. The day you're listening to this. Yeah, the day you're listening to this. We are at the Canton Palace Theater for the Ohio premiere of Momo. So if you're a loyal listener from the state of Ohio, you can come see the movie at the Canton Palace Theater. Tickets, $7. Doors open at 7. I don't have the address in front of me, but Canton Palace Theater is like right downtown Canton. So you can come see the movie. We'll all, everyone in this room right now will be there.
Momo will be there too.
Momo?
Yeah.
Your mama?
My mom will be there, but Momo will be there.
You get a picture with Jason's mom.
Yeah, come get a picture with Jason's mom.
My mom will take a picture with you.
So, what else do we have? Oh, Mothman Festival on the 21st and 22nd, we're doing a special screening of Terror in the Skies and Momo, the Missouri Monster, at the State Theater in downtown Point Pleasant on the 20th. Again, we're giving this warning at the beginning of every episode. If you're planning on coming to the Mothman Festival and you want to be at the screening at the State Theater, you need to be there at least a minimum of 45 minutes early. We're well over 10,000 people on the event page now. And it's not, typically these event pages are real iffy. Like you can't really go off the numbers on those. But at this point, if 1/10 of the 10,000 show up, you're going to be way, way, way past the capacity for the State Theater, which can only handle just under 300 people. So we, and this has traditionally been our single busiest night of the year for the last 3 years. So we're expecting it to be just as crazy this year. So if you're going to try to come, you need to get there early. Oh, and also you'll be able to get like the Mothman Legacy t-shirts and all that stuff that we have for the special for the festival. Beyond that, we don't have anything else until we get to November, and bring fans, because there's no air conditioning. But we'll be at Western Pennsylvania Conference on the Unexplained on Saturday, November 9th, and Sunday, November 10th. And again, that is taking place at the Ramada Greensburg Hotel and Conference Center. We're showing Invasion on Chestnut Ridge and Momo. And it's fitting we're showing Invasion on Chestnut Ridge because it's Greensburg is the Chestnut Ridge. So I think that's it for events. I can't think of anything else. We do have trips coming up. We're doing some filming. I'm going to Disney World. Yeah. So a lot of stuff. So anyway, this week we wanted to talk about Momo with the entire core group minus Adrian and Andy as well. Mm-hmm. So we're missing two key members.
Missing Brandon too.
Well, come on. Okay, frickin' Brandon. Well, like I guess what I was thinking is like the group that was there for that. The meeting where we kind of figured everything. No, he wasn't. He wasn't able to be a part of Momo. It was weird because he was involved in the UFO shoot, which kind of came in the middle of post-production. Yeah. So to me, it feels like he was part of it because he was with us in like Arizona and stuff. But it was weird. One thing. So Brandon does all the music in the Small Town Monsters movies, and he moved to LA. Right after we finished shooting Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. So of the movies we've done since Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, he's only been able to be a part of Bray Road for like 2 days that he spent on Tinder. And
what do you do?
He spent a lot of time swiping right on Tinder.
Yeah, he didn't like what he saw.
No. What was the other? No, he had to. Oh, yeah. I guess you're right. It was Bray. That's it. That's all he's been involved in since Invasion on Chestnut Ridge.
Oh,
he was at Mothman Fest.
On the trail of.
Well, on the trail of, yeah. He was there for one in day Adams of filming County. for the Adams County shoot. He flew in for less than 36 hours. He flew in.
He was a sleepy Brandon.
He was barely awake. Oh, Shannon was like that too. Yeah. Shannon was here less time. Shannon was here less than 24 hours.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So anyway, Momo the Missouri Monster, we talked about this like last week, a little bit of the pre-production. So you're going to have to help me guide this show a little bit more because I'll probably be forgetting where we're going. But we talked about the pre-production stuff and how the meetings were structured and how we sort of like fleshed out the entire idea behind the show in advance. But I'm not sure, since you weren't here, maybe we can talk to you about like what was going on your end when you got into the writing stages after you and I had the meetings we had regarding story and then met with Mark, because I talked about it last week. Like we sent the script off for Mark and Mark took the first pass at it. And then you did the bulk of the additions. Like I really only touched up sentences here and there, but you added a bunch, especially to the opening sequence with the Mary and Joan Hart.
Joan Hart.
I don't know why I said that.
Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling if I ever get to write again, it's just not going to be that easygoing. It was just a really fluid process. You know, we all took our turns and made suggestions on what to cut out.
But you, like, especially added stuff. So when we were in the very early stages of like putting the script together, Adrian had actually said something about how it's really important to at the beginning of the movie to help set the stage for the time period. And that was one of the reasons we were adamant about getting that VW Beetle, was like we knew we needed a car that we could have in there where like instantly you kind of feel like you're in the 70s. And you added all the stuff about like Alice Cooper and the time period.
Yeah, I think Alice Cooper was kind of, I mean, for me, that's a way to just nod to him because I love Alice Cooper, but also my whole introduction to all things horror, I think, came from my family listening to Alice Cooper while I was growing up. So I think it's kind of a nod to them. But it also, I mean, that tour and that stage show that I'm referencing was going on probably not necessarily in the summer where the sighting actually occurred, but the summer when this fictional crew would have been making this movie in 75 or 76.
Yeah, I mean, that is point. Something that gets confusing is the timeline of the movie, because you've got three dates that are referenced. You got 71, where Mary and Joan had their encounter, and then you get 72, which is the Harrison House stuff. But the movie, the fictional movie that's playing out through the course of the movie is supposed to be made in 75. We did that because it more than likely wouldn't have been a Charles B. Pierce situation where he's literally making the movie in the heart of like the Falcon Monster hysteria. But we set it in 75 just I guess to give it some runtime between like when the actual events would have happened. Right? Is that all?
Yeah.
72 is when it was made, right?
Yeah.
And then it was released in 73?
I thought it came out in 72.
72.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and in my mind, this is, you know, a couple of years later and a crew essentially trying to accomplish what they did with the Legend of Bloody Creek, basically.
This Creature from Black Lake came out in 76, so it sort of
splits really?
The
it's
difference.
Like right in there.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. What
then? Creature from Black Lake. That's interesting, too. That's cool. That is all in the setup for the movie, the narrative film, too. But we had a meeting at the house. Do you remember like the meeting where the five of us sat down? Well, Mark wasn't at the meeting, but Mark was there in spirit. What at that point, like you were going to be in the movie and producing it. What were you thinking at that point in time? Cause you more than anyone that was there that night were kind of not an outsider, but like you had never
just
been a part
say
of
it like it is.
Well, you never been a part of like that end of
right.
an STM thing. And your experience with STM was as a, like a straight ahead doc.
Right. Yeah.
Sort of company. So like, what were you thinking at that point?
It was, it was the first experience I had like, in any capacity with that setting, like just sitting down the very beginning of anything and seeing, like you said, like I had just been on the trail of and that kind of stuff and just seeing that happen. So it was interesting to see like the process of thinking back now, thinking of the things that I remember us talking about around that table and seeing how they did change. But I mean, really what the most impressive thing for me is really what was set up like at that table really was what came to fruition, like at the end. Like there wasn't a ton of change. Like I can't remember if it was you or if it was Jason sitting there talking about like, what if we had Lyle hosting a show?
That's all Jason.
Yeah, talking. And I remember that. And I was like, I remember everyone was like, that's so cool. And that ended up being the foundation of the whole movie. And that was set right there, which I thought was a pretty cool thing, like to see that idea. And at the very end, that's exactly what happened. Like it was a very clear, I think, picture of what wanted to happen from that first day. It was interesting to like look back on that now.
When I said that idea out loud, I honestly wasn't sure if anybody was gonna go for it. So
it was my biggest trepid
scared us.
Yeah, I was really that was my biggest trepidation with the entire movie was Lyle's role as like a, because that wasn't how I saw the movie going at all until that night. And in my head, it was always the entire movie other than the narrative was straightforward. And my concern then, and now I don't have this concern, but my concern then was that you would be, it would almost be too much, fictional. No, because I didn't think it was going to be super humorous, but like I thought it would be almost too much fictional content versus, but now to me those sections with Lyle are very, they're, well, it's like a lot, it's like you said about splitting the difference when you were talking about the dates. It's the same thing with Lyle's section, is splitting the difference between reality and fiction, because everything Lyle's saying is true. And he's basically playing himself, but he's playing a slightly fictionalized version of himself. So it cuts There's something about that that I think really adds as a good, right?
Yeah, right. And I think that's where the original concept may have even been more helpful in a sense, because sort of it was like a horror host, like Count Lyle.
Yes.
And I had a costume character almost. And maybe, you know, we were talking before we started recording that there's maybe some of the static that people have is they're so used to seeing Lyle. They just assume the Lyle Blackburn of Cryptid, you know, the show is Lyle Blackburn and not sort of a character, where the Count Lyle may have helped people actually to make that differentiation, like, oh, he's being someone, as opposed to there he is. So it's Lyle as we know him, and he's making that.
Well, Lyle just didn't want to do Count Lyle.
I think also when I threw that idea out there, and even probably well into the production, like I was pushing for it to be way zanier than it was. And I'm so thankful that nobody listened to that. Like Lyle would have been telling like hacky drive time radio jokes and
you know,
Monica Lewinsky and all this. Janet Reno. Is that Momo or Janet Reno? Yeah.
No, I did like, there was one concept early on of Lyle like walking out of the cornfield in a suit, like a Peter Graves or a Rod Serling. I thought that really had potential. That could have been pretty cool too.
Well, and I think one thing about this that we're seeing is that people are really responding to the movie, but also to Lyle's stuff. So I think now I'm seeing a lot of people like, when are we going to get a Blackburn's Cryptid Case Files?
Right.
Show like on its own as well. So that's kind of funny to see. But that meeting where we all sat down there, that's the biggest takeaway I have from that meeting, is that it completely, for me, altered the movie drastically from what I saw. Because even though we knew it was a narrative, part narrative and part documentary, Lyle's scenes were just supposed to be straightforward. So that almost changed the tone of the entire movie in a way.
That there were many moments during this production where I was fairly confident that I had ruined the entire movie, and that was the first one.
What was the next?
When we were filming the posse scene in the woods, I had set up this whole organizational system for myself so I could keep track of the different files and
sound wise.
And the backups. And I figured out as soon as we got there that, and we had one pass at this. I mean, the amount of people that we took out in the woods that night, it was like 30 plus.
Yeah. We got to get,
there was no organization.
Well, I want to go through like scene by scene a little bit in a second. Because that's making me think of how insane that night was.
Like the crickets were so loud that we just had to live with whatever we got.
Yeah.
And I also found out that I couldn't walk with the boom and pay attention to the levels and how we operate. I'm sure if I would have, you know, said something, somebody would have stepped in, but we don't have PAs. So it was just everything by the seat of our pants, and I'm like, this audio is going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
I think I had you and the Parfits check it out, because
on one shot,
yeah,
there was one shot where I remember the Parfits
and John, I just kind of, you know, used that input there as a barometer for whether or not it was working and just hoped for the best. But I did not go home feeling great about the audio that night.
Sticking with pre-production for a second. So we got into, we went into scripting. The first script was Mark. You added all the Alice Cooper opening stuff, and then you added lines throughout, and I adjusted on that. Zach, the first time you looked,
I didn't write it.
The first time you saw the script, what was your thought process? Like, what did you think when you saw the script for the first time?
I could definitely tell Jason's input right from the opening lines about Alice Cooper. I knew that's what he or had contributed to. I loved it. My first read through of it, I think I texted you guys that it was something special, something. It was going to be hard.
Yeah, that's what I think. Logistically,
I couldn't vision or envision any of it at that. It was I honestly had no idea of certain things, and I still halfway through I didn't offer how it would come together.
And it's funny because like anything that is cut from the movie was nothing that was cut because of logistically how to film it. It was the scenes that were cut were just stuff we never got to. The rain that ruined the fishing scene.
It's crazy how the percentage of what we put down on paper actually made it in, because it's most of it.
What about you when you saw the script? Because you were playing the lead character. I mean, did you have concerns from the outset about the movie?
No, I don't think I had concerns, and I think that comes from just like ignorance is bliss. Like I mean, this is the first time I'd been a part of something like it, so I was like, oh, cool, they put these things down on paper, and then this is what you film, and then I think the more concerns for me, and they weren't concerns because you guys are great at what you do, is just being out there in it and seeing it and being like, this is organized chaos for sure.
Oh yeah,
like how does there's, what
if, I mean honestly by the time we got to the posse, and again like we're gonna go but by the time we got to the posse sequence, organization was gone,
right?
There was nothing that was, so I didn't have any concern
initially.
Chaos.
It was just in the middle of it, like, whoa, this is nuts. I mean, it was like, you know, what is that, herding cats, like, but it was just herding a bunch of grown adult men cats everywhere in the woods. There's a few moments there, like it's kind of surreal, like you're standing in the middle, it's nighttime, there are cameras and a boom over you and whatever, and you're like, oh, this is gonna, like, we're actually gonna do this, like it's gonna be something that people watch, probably need to take it serious. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it was crazy though. It was organized chaos for sure.
Some of the feedback we're getting, like regarding acting and stuff, the Steve Bissett talked about you as like the stoic, like perfectly cast, like acted 70s lead. Did you do like, because I don't know how acting works, because I'm not in the movie acting. Mm. Do you do that on purpose, or like what is your thinking in terms of like acting in those scenes?
Yeah, it was really different for me, because I had acted in a lot of stuff, but it was like play production. Like I had been in a lot of theater in high school and college, which is a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. It's you overact on everything. And I think I was really conscious of that fact and wanted to underact on everything.
Well, also I kept instructing everyone, play everything straight.
Right.
To
play it straight. Because was, I think the nature of the movie was that no matter how straight you played it, it's still a,
just the nature of what we're doing.
Right. It's still a 1970s Bigfoot movie. Like it's going to, however straight you try to play it, it's going to come off in a slightly different way. So I think if any of us were to have really overacted, it would have just been like, it would have not come, it wouldn't have shown well, I don't think. But it was a conscious decision to underact, because my tendency would be to overact, just given that on a stage performing to a live audience, you have to emote like way over what you normally would. And then, you know, and then you're obviously dealing with you're talking back and forth with other people and kids, which was an interesting thing, which I had never
did you about. Watch Close Encounters at all? I can't remember.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Like Jason and I, that was what Jason and I kept talking about. And I don't know if we talked about that much at all either, but like Jason and I, for some reason, when we were script, like plotting the movie, we talked a lot about Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we got into, is there anything else we want to hit on pre-pro? Like, I can't remember. There was, we need to mention Santino Vitale, who did all the character design and everything. And it again, like, I really would encourage people to check out Steve Bissett's review of Momo, because, like, it perfectly, he got the movie in and out. Like, the whole thing, he totally got.
Yeah, and a guy like that, I mean, that's the guy that I'm really happy with impressing. Mm-hmm. Probably out of... I mean, I'm happy it's connecting with a lot of people, but that's really high praise to me.
Yeah, so check out his review, because he talks about like the costume and it's just like the inherent cheesiness of the costume and how it's like perfectly time period appropriate and all that stuff. So we got into the first day of production was on the car sequence, the VW car scene, and no one in this room is actually in that scene. but that was our first day of filming, and we immediately were into trying to shoot on a green screen, which I had decided just days before, if I'm not mistaken, that we were going to just
shoot other time green was
Flatwoods. Yeah, but Santino immediately told us he thought he could do everything. Yeah. We had to comp in, so we comped in all that stuff. So basically, we just set up a green screen in the garage at my sister's house on either side of the car, and then shot the coverage. We shot the scene multiple times from three different angles. There is footage from the beginning that is from the road that I shot, but most of the footage where you're seeing on the green screen, Santino bought. That's like mostly stock footage because I just couldn't get out to shoot that footage. This is going to be the biggest thing was you could see the slits in the wood on the barn. It reflected in the window. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And you and I were really concerned about that because you could see it on the camera. Like you could see the barn in the windshield. And Santino was like, "Nah, I'll be fine." So like we just were. If you watch the uncut footage, he's trying to make it look like
things passing,
like things passing through the windshield. Those. There's like shadows that move across their face. That's just Santino in the upper, and you can see his arms in the upper like right hand corner of the screen, like moving past the
really
lights.
Really cool to watch. I mean, it really was like to see what came out and then what was actually happening right there. Mm-hmm. It's pretty crazy.
And I think we had there was only one time where we moved it. Because we had the back screen was fine, and then there was the left side, and then we had to move it to the right side eventually for the third. But there were three shots, and then we did multiple takes of each. And I would say that part of the movie took up like 4 hours, 5 hours, getting all that stuff like set up and then shooting it all. Yeah, it looks really good. And the sound is great. How did you had like the microphone down in the...
I think I taped it to the gear shift. Yep. So that it was just kind of angled up between both of them.
I mean,
a lot of tapes.
Yeah, I mean, I would say
tape things. We taped lights on the all over the place.
We had tape
LED lights.
We probably go through Gorilla tape and duct tape and gaffer tape more than anything. The that is something about SDM that became really apparent on Momo when you're trying to shoot a narrative is how small the crew is, because like there's. It doesn't matter. Like everyone at some point was working. Like actually the night before we filmed that scene, Elizabeth, who's in that scene, Elizabeth Saint, was like helping us take gear out to my sister's house and like unload gear and stuff. And she's like the actress in that scene was helping us. Oh yeah.
Lugging stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
Alexander was helping with stuff.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that scene because we got to talk about that scene's probably the craziest night of my life. Like the opening of that scene is where, not the opening, but when Momo first shows up was where I started to think this is not going to work. Because the first time Momo shows up on the hill, we were at a distance. So this is such a learning. It was starting to rain, but this was such a learning curve for us because Zach and I had never, we'd never needed to shoot things like coverage and ever. Like we'd never needed to do that stuff. Like our recreations are always just like, get the shots you need and then I'll figure out how to cut. And this one, you're like, okay, we got to get a shot of her like picking up the purse off the back seat and all that stuff. And even coming away from it, we didn't have nearly enough coverage. Like there's a lot of things missing.
We were going by the dot list for
this. I didn't shot list that day.
You didn't shot
list? There was some stuff on my phone and there was the script and we were just trying to get what was there. And the same thing happens I think with the posse sequence. We end up going direct. I had a shot list. We'll talk about the posse sequence.
Because we
were shooting that scene almost chronologically too, is the other thing with the girls in the car to meeting Momo for the first time into the end of that scene was shot almost chronologically. We did not have, so it was raining really bad and JD had left. So by the time it gets to the shot where the girls are supposed to drive away,
the car's stuck
in the mud and JD's gone. So we didn't have anyone that could get the car out. So 2 weeks before we wrapped the entire movie, it might have been the week we wrapped the entire movie, I went back to Sarah's house, my sister's house. My dad is the one driving the car. When the car peels out and drives away, that's my dad driving the car. And JD is wearing one leg of the Momo foot, and he just stomps down. That's just JD stepping in, and you can see like the sky is completely different. Like it's broad daylight, it's like sun's heart, you know, it's like a really hard sun. And that was shot months after the initial scene was shot. Did it, you guys have anything else to add about that particular scene as far as like the filming went? I just was
when
convinced
you saw Momo on the hill that you thought it wasn't gonna work. I thought that shot was.
I had see in my head, the movie itself was a little different than what ended up being on screen, because to me, the movie was, I wanted it to be scary and silly at the same time.
Well,
and still serious, like the family drama. Even the narrative film itself is like a tightrope to walk, because you don't, in no way do we ever want to poke fun at like the Harrison family. So it's not doing that. But you want to have fun with what you're doing with like the 70s setting and the way the movie is and all of that kind of stuff. And the first time we were doing the zooms past the girls who were standing there screaming and pointing, I thought this is moving into parody. Like this is beyond where I wanted it to be originally, which was I was always really conscious when I was talking to you guys about like, let's not do a parody. We don't want it to be a parody. And I thought it was starting to move in that direction when we were doing that. But once I got into post, that scene isn't parody. It just mimics something they would have done in the 70s. Like, so there were things that I had big concerns about that once I saw them on screen completely changed the way I felt about the shot of Momo running up to the window when she's rolling up the window still kind of creeps me out.
I remember being there and looking at the playback for that, and it was just like, I think all of our faces were.
The other thing was
important.
Was shot was so shaky, and he's out of focus. And I think that was Ken's idea to run over that log.
So to say, when he leaps that log thing, and I didn't want him to do it. Flow a little bit and jump over.
Yeah, because it was soaking wet, and he's running around.
He comes off to the right there.
Yeah,
and the camera's coming. He's kind of out of focus. I feel like that scene in particular was.
And it was important really that scary. The actresses sold that they were scared, that they weren't like ha ha scared, but they were really. Yeah. Upset, and they did that, I thought, really well.
I was in the back of that car with screaming.
So that's one thing I want to talk about is that that there is a shot in there that's probably the most complicated shot we've ever done in an STM movie, the handoff.
That was
through the window?
Because there's a shot where the Zach's in the back of the car capturing them talking back and forth about how Elizabeth Mary? Which one's Mary and which one's Joan? I can't think right now.
I can't.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth is talking about how she needs to get the keys. The camera's in the back of the car. It's all one take. They go back and forth for like 30 seconds talking about how, you know, like Janet's like, you shouldn't run, whatever. She gets out of the car and Zach hands the camera out the window to me. I run with her to grab the keys, run back, and then had to pass the camera back into the car. And it works really cool.
Yeah, it looked really cool.
I mean, I had to do a lot of cropping around you in the mirror in that scene because I kept leaving it in.
Well, the roof was only...
Yeah. You know, it was that car is tiny.
Yeah. And the seats didn't move, so we were like...
It was claustrophobic. Yeah, and then that huge wasp got in the back window.
Yeah. No way.
So they sprayed hairspray.
Yeah, I think Elizabeth had hairspray.
Yeah.
Just drenched it. Or maybe it was Janet.
They killed like this massive wasp in the back of the car with hairspray.
But that car, I mean, I initially tried to record the sound from the back, and I'm not a big guy, and I couldn't fit back there at all. Mm-hmm. So the mic just had to be left in the car.
Yeah.
Yeah, then wasn't it in between the seats?
I think for that, I taped it to the back seat. Yeah.
And it was raining. It's raining on and off. And if you watch the scene, I mean, it's pretty obvious. There's like water on the windshield and stuff, which why would they be having a picnic in the rain? Yeah, that's what Santino kept pointing out. But
it's an 80s music video at that point.
We started that day at like 7 a.m. or something over at the barn and wrapped at maybe like 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And when
it really wasn't that long.
It wasn't an insanely long day for what we did. I think at that point though, I was just really concerned about coverage. I was just like, I don't think we have enough. And like I said, that was like a good lesson for us as filmmakers, is like, shoot more than you need, because in the future I'm gonna remember that. There's things in that scene I still wish I'd gotten around to getting and wasn't able to. But the next day, we're gonna talk about the next day, and then I think we're gonna cut because we're already at 35 minutes, and we're gonna hit the next day, which was supposed to. So the next day went completely off the rails. The next day was supposed to be, the next day was supposed to be the Wendorf talking on the phone, just Wendorf's side of the phone call.
Mrs. Sutter.
Mrs. Sutter scenes. And then, man, I forget.
And it was supposed to be fishing.
The fishing scene. Yeah. And so we got, the Wendorf scene we got through. My dad had a hard time with his line, so he only did about maybe like half of his lines and we cut them. But I've talked to people that have seen the movie and they've told me that he's their favorite actor in the movie. So I think he did a really good job with that scene. Sue's scene and your scene was super easy. Like, I remember thinking this day's going to go good. Cause like, I was really enjoying shooting that stuff, like the quieter, like talking scenes. And I was having fun with stuff on that shoot that you were not happy with. I was doing like quick zooms and slow zooms in on your face, and you were irritated about the fact that I was zooming in on you.
I texted you so much about it. You said, I'm going to stop sending you stuff because you won't shut up. And that's Seth Breedlove.
Director.
Director Seth Breedlove.
But then, like, halfway through that Sutter scene, it started raining on and off. And in some of the behind the scenes, there's like, there's umbrellas. And actually, there was an umbrella over the camera at one point. And there was a big scene we had to shoot that day. We had to go over to where ended up shooting the Bonehouse scene and do this. Yeah, and do this sequence where the boys are supposed to encounter Momo while they're fishing. And this scene got cut from the final movie. But this was supposed to be the boys and Andy. And Andy didn't even get to be in the movie because of this. But as soon as we got over there, it started downpouring.
And so it didn't then it
was
stop.
Torrential downpour. So we're over there. We've got the fog. I'm trying to get the fog machine out and the generator, and we're just trying. Yeah, we lugged everything down there, and we're like, let's just do it. And we're like trying to get these shots, and it got so bad. And then halfway through shooting this, Jason finds out he has a tick.
Yeah, I look down, and there's just a tick dug into my gut.
Yeah, so Jason's got a tick, and it's
crouching down.
Umbrellas. Yeah, they had umbrellas over all the equipment and stuff, trying not to get soaked, like the new camera and everything. And we were down there for maybe like 20 minutes. We weren't even there that long, but I was looking at the radar on Weather Channel, and you could tell that this was not going to let up. And we called it. So we had to call. So that scene did not get filmed, and we were fully intent on shooting that scene at a later day, and it just never happened. So that sequence got cut, and
that might be the only time we've ever called something too.
Yeah. Normally we'd just work around it, but it really was like, it was a downpour, and I could tell from the hourly that we were going to be,
we wouldn't have equipment.
Yeah.
We would have kept going.
No, the camera would have been drenched. So anyway,
going back to the Sutter scene,
Just
tell the story of the cast really quick.
I think
That's pretty funny.
So we wanted to have a cast, and we had Plaster. So we showed up that day. Who made the cast? Ken?
No, I carved it.
Okay.
And then he poured it.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Okay, so.
And then try to scoop it out.
So Adam created the cast, or the footprint.
The mold.
Yeah, and then Ken poured the plaster, and then during the shoot of that scene, the little toe or the big toe?
It could have been the pinky toe, I think.
Yeah, falls off the cast. So when in that scene, when he pulls it up out of the ground, and you can really clearly tell, it's broke. It's broke. But we didn't have another 2 hours to stand there waiting for another plaster cast, and it was pouring, so it wouldn't matter. Or it was starting to rain by the time we finished that. So we just went with what we had. But that cast is sitting in my parents' garage. We needed to get that so we can have it here in the museum.
Yeah.
But yeah, that The cast is broke, though, unfortunately.
It looked good, though.
I think it's super cool.
I think it looked
it's really a cool cast. It's a cool moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Just in general, my favorite moments in the movie tend to be those little things. Like, I really love the crazy board scene, too, which is a very, very different from what it was supposed to be. But it's, I love the little quiet moments. So anyway, that took us all the way through. There was supposed to, so we'll talk about it when we get to talking about shooting that. But that scene, that scene went through three changes. There was originally supposed to be the actual MoMA, the Missouri Monster song from the 70s was going to play under it. Then John was going to do sort of an audio montage that would play under it with like where Edgar's supposed to be sort of replaying people saying different things from the earlier in the movie, mostly his kids. And then it went to where it is now, where it's just a straight ahead silent scene. I'm still not really sure why the audio montage didn't happen, but what are you going to do? So anyway, that takes us through the second day of filming, all the way through pre-production, second day of filming. So we're going to wrap up for this week, and then next week we're going to hit sort of the rest of the shoot, which is where the fun will begin. We'll get right into like the posse sequence, which was the big Bobo Cliff, Bonehouse, Adam almost died stuff that people will enjoy hearing. Again, if you're listening to this, we are showing the movie at the Palace tonight or Friday the 13th. If you're listening after the fact, forget about it. And we'll be playing MoMA, the Missouri Monster at the State Theater in Point Pleasant, West Virginia on September 20th. That's a free event. Come see it. And on DVD, September 20th, and Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, and VidiSpace. If you're not into all this behind-the-scenes production stuff, fear not. We will be back with more paranormal themed episodes in the next few weeks, but this is a Small Town Monsters podcast, so we got to make sure we represent the production side of what we do. I think that does it for this week. We'll be back next week.
Back after this.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.